gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, and you know, truer words have never been sung. I am indeed walking on sunshine, which is actually something I don't recommend. It's quite dangerous. It can actually be accomplished through... physically, it is impossible. But let that not diminish your joy this morning. It is Monday. I am filling in this week for Steph and the Mooks while they are away on vacation, leading into this 4th of July weekend that we have coming up, and of which I wish you a fantastic one. It has been... a crazy weekend, the last few months. I mean, I've been gone. For those of you that follow the Hump Days with Hal, I've spent the last 2 weeks in London, England, and Donington Park in England doing comedy shows, doing the comedy. And then I went immediately to Kentucky afterwards to do the equivalent of swimming in a nice warm bath and then dunking your head in a bucket of ice. That was the emotional equivalent of what I went through, coming from London doing stand-up shows and then going right to Kentucky and having to explain everything I say twice. But that being said, and by the way, I'm allowed to talk like that. I'm from there. I'm glad that Steph and the Mooks are taking a vacation. They have been under a lot of strain lately. It's been very tense. A lot going on, not just with the BP spill, but leading up to the... Elena Kagan, her confirmation hearings start today. She has been called a lesbian, but that's not right at my point. She's been called that through code words by the right, but she's been called the most boring candidate for the Supreme Court in the history of judicial nominees. And quite frankly, I think that's kind of brilliant. This might be the single greatest judicial move Obama has made, to make someone appear so vanilla and dull, and at the same time a mysterious closet lesbian at the exact same time. These are the two versions of Elena Kagan that exist in the media right now. And so from that, Obama is going to get his second judicial nominee on the high court. There is no question they will hem, they will haw, they will pitch, and they will yaw, but they will never stop Elena Kagan. They will bring up a couple of things where the worst thing that they've been able to find, by the way, so far, is the fact that she called the judicial nominating process boring and pointless and a piece of theater, essentially. And so they're going to go, oh, yes. So you think this whole thing is just a sham and it's not important, that we're not asking real questions, but here's my real questions that I've been asked to ask you by my handlers. Abortion and women, and didn't you say that some people deserve more rights than others? And corporations who pay my salary, shouldn't you? I don't know, let her in. That's how it'll go. That's what if you remember the Sonia Sotomayor debacle last year, how long and drawn out that was. This will be a pittance in comparison. This will zip by. It will be largely forgotten, mainly because this is not ammo for them to attack the president as strongly as they would like it to be, and they just need to get on back to the areas where they feel like they can win in the election. Elena Kagan is not a winning issue. If they knock her down and have to start the judicial nominating process over, it actually acts against them. So the Republicans and the GOP and the conservatives, which we, by the way, have to divide into several different groups at this point, because I don't think there's an actual conservative movement that stands, presently, there's kind of these factions. They've kind of split up, kind of like the Empire after the Emperor was killed. I don't want to get too Star Wars on you, but trust me, it's a valid analogy. excuse me, I'm also fighting having lost my voice, which is a fantastic time to do radio. It actually, I think it makes it more radio ready, wouldn't you say, Tony? I mean, Tony's with us here today in studio as well, and is fighting a similar situation, yeah. Normally he's just a chatterbox, but he's going to try and keep it to a minimum this go around. and we actually It's fascinating. We have coming up this hour at the half-hour mark, we have the rude pundit. Lee Papa is going to be joining us to be particularly rude, but not as rude as he is on his website, which is rudepundit.blogspot.com, I believe. But we will clarify that when he is on the air so I can make that 100% sure. But he will be with us to kind of deal with a couple of major news stories, and this is what we will be dealing with today. Obviously, the passing of Robert Byrd, very sad. I believe the oldest member of the Senate, very, very old gentleman who really fought against physical illness very hard to come in and vote for that health care bill and make sure that it got through as much as, you know, fighting for it as much as Kennedy did, really caring about this. At one point, becoming kind of grumpy that they kept dragging him back in the middle of the night to re-vote on things as the Republicans kept fighting it. But he did it, man. He rolled in there, and it may have gotten the best of him because he passed away this morning or early last night, depending on how you look at it. And he will be sorely missed. And one of the other stories we will be looking at, of course, we will talk about the BP oil spill and how basically we have set up a situation here over the course of the last three decades, actually, to create the not just the potential, but the guarantee of environmental calamity by corporations. We have literally put rules in place that are never enforced, or people who have been put in there to make sure that they are not enforced, basically a bribe system set up within the government, especially since Reagan, to make sure that those rules are never written, and if they are, they can be gutted by putting an idiot in charge with whenever they get an office to take care of. But the main issue that we're dealing with is oil is not the only area. It's getting a lot of attention, but between coal ash and the waste from factory farms and all these untreated elements of waste from major corporations that are allowed to happen on a level of insanity, on a level that if you or I wanted to start a business and we went to the Secretary of State and filed our paperwork and said, I'm going to start a business. I want to run a coffee shop in my town. It's going to be a fantastic coffee shop, and it's going to supply coffee to the entire Los Angeles area at high quality and stuff. However, over the course of every single year, I will murder or sicken 15 people at a minimum. They would throw you in jail at the filing office. But a lot of corporations now run under that exact system. Pharmaceutical companies, chemical companies, oil companies, factory farms. There's a level of pollution and contamination that they are allowed to get away with. And one of the reasons why Tony Hayward, the CEO of BP, was complaining so much. Remember when he said, I want my life back, but he also kind of couldn't understand why everybody was so mad at him. Why in the world are you so mad at me? I mean, we're just dumping 60,000 gallons of oil into the Gulf a day. It's essentially an Exxon Valdez a week. But in all fairness, Shell Oil dumps that same amount in the Nigerian Delta every year. The amount of oil that will be spilled between when it started and when it hopefully is stopped in August when the relief well is dug. That amount of oil that is escaping into the Gulf goes into the Nigerian Delta every single year. Every single year. Shell has been responsible for this for decades now. The reason he's complaining is because they never get busted. That's because they leak it in Africa, where nobody seems to give a crap what you do to the infrastructure, to the people. And that's where when people seem like they can't imagine how out of touch this guy is. How in the world can he think that it's okay to say something like this? He lives on a different plane of existence. He hobnobs with corporate entities and corporate people who write memos that they know will result in the deaths of tens of thousands of people and never see the inside of a courtroom over it. Maximum, they'll pay a $24,000 fine, something along those lines. It's insanity. But it's an insanity that they're, quite frankly, used to. We're going to take a break. I want to make sure that we stay on our breaks today, Tony, because we have a lot to talk about in this. And I want to really get Rude Pundit's talk on this as well. We will also be dealing with the fact that CIA Chief Leon Panetta said that if you do the math, anyways, what he effectively said that we have 1,000 soldiers in Iraq for every one Al Qaeda member that is there, and we are spending I think it's somewhere in the odds of $1 million per Al Qaeda member to get them. He said there's less than 100, probably around 50. This is what we're in Afghanistan for. There are 300 active serial killers in the United States at any given time, according to the FBI. There are 50 Al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. Priorities much? We'll figure it out. Anyways, we will be back right after this. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEPH12 is our number. I would love to hear from you on some of these issues. And, of course, we will be talking with Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, and the bottom half of the hour. But we will be right back. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
That was strangely arousing.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Like we're getting a call there, Tony. Look at that. 1-800-STEP12 is the number. That's probably why. It's Hal Sparks. I'm filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation, and they get an extra weekend. They get to play out that long weekend and really turn it into, you know, a full vacation for themselves. And quite frankly, they deserve it. It's just the pressure involved in the number of stories that are going on. If you think it's hard talking about it, I cannot imagine being this president. Can you imagine? I mean, walking in with the mess that's already there and then stack upon stack upon stack, not the least of which Stanley McChrystal got his walking papers last week, mainly because, and a lot of people believe, quite frankly, that he did it on purpose, that he actually said these things because he knew it would end up in him being removed from his position and replaced because things were not going well, and he knew it would keep going badly, and that there was no way to make it look good on his watch, so better to get kicked out for some other reason and then, you know, and kind of have people forget you were ever in charge. That's quite frankly, that seems to be the plan on some level. That being said, Leon Panetta, and I'm going to read this little piece to you off my beloved iPad, which, by the way, you can watch. We're streaming live all this week while I'm filling in for Steph at halsparks.com/Ustream. You can watch us on there. Join in the chat. We got a bunch of people in there already getting up bright and early and contributing to this conversation. It's a great way also if you have a question or a comment and you feel like you might not be able to get through when you're calling in and those kind of things, this is a great way to do it. But Leon, CIA Chief Leon Panetta in Afghanistan says he's being interviewed and Jake Tapper, who's the ABC This Week host, asks him, how many Al-Qaeda do you think are in Afghanistan? And Panetta's answer is, I think the estimate on the number of Al-Qaeda is actually relatively small. I think at most we're looking at 50 to 100, maybe less. It's in that vicinity. There's no question the main location of Al-Qaeda is in the tribal areas of Pakistan. Now, so that, you know, a lot of people will rush to, oh, well, then what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan? Why don't we just pack up out of there and head into Pakistan? Well, okay, first of all, we are. Make no mistake about it, we are operating with and in cooperation with and directly with the Pakistani government. We are fearlessly going into that place on a fairly regular basis with drones and covert ops. There's no question that we're doing that. I mean, whether you talk about it or not, it's happening. Everybody would be a fool to think it's not. Through diplomacy and through the tacit acceptance of the Pakistani government to allow us to go into that area, part of the value of Afghanistan becomes the staging area aspect. becomes that that is the major staging area for going into the rougher parts, which are the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, that being said, there are still tremendous a tremendous fight going on in Afghanistan, in that the Taliban and the harder elements of the Taliban are really trying to maintain control. The leader of the president, Karzai of Afghanistan, was the one person who came to the defense of McChrystal, which was kind of funny because it really, with friends like that, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I think he's great. Keep it down, buddy. You're not helping me. You, of all people, are not who we want to hear from. So this is... Here we have a situation which is essentially untenable. And the, Obama was asked about this at the G20. You know, about how long we're going to be there, about the drawdown, those kind of things. And this is from the Associated Press. President Barack Obama said Sunday that there's a lot of obsession with the withdrawal date for U.S. troops from Afghanistan. He said his focus is on making sure the mission there is successful. Now, politically, that's a twofold statement. On the one hand, it's true that in any kind of war theater, there is no way to guarantee a drawdown date, no matter what. I mean, it's as unpredictable as the oil spill. There are two elements of his the essential fight in Afghanistan, which is the what they're calling the counterinsurgency strategy, which is we're going to go in there, we're going to work this long-term strategy to kind of win hearts and minds and fight back the Taliban and capture certain areas, hold them, move on to the next, that kind of idea. The problem with that one is that there's a window of opportunity on how long that takes before it's not an actual workable solution. Counterinsurgency is not a strategy that works over the course of 7 to 10 years. It's the kind of thing that works over the course of a year or 2 years, and if it's not working by then it's 100% political what you've got to go through. You've got to kind of scrap the whole thing and go, okay, we're creating more bad guys by how we're acting. So, like I said, one element that Obama's up against is the fact that what he's saying is essentially true, that he doesn't have he says, I don't have a crystal ball. Was the exact quote that everybody kind of jumped on. I don't have a crystal ball, the president said when asked about a 5-year Afghanistan exit strategy endorsed Saturday by the group of 8 major industrial democracies. These are the ones who are involved in the NATO forces as well. So he said, I think that right now the debate surrounding Afghanistan is presented as either we get up and leave immediately because there's no chance at a positive outcome, or we stay basically indefinitely and do quote unquote whatever it takes for as long as it takes. This and Obama's policy is somewhere in the middle is the concern with everybody, which quite frankly is where life is, and in dealing with a war, I'm a big fan of us getting out of there and handling this from a diplomatic stretch. That being said, the Taliban moving through Pakistan and that being a shaky government, getting their hands on a nuclear weapon is got to be something that's keeping everybody in the government awake at night. So you understand how they're not going to lay down an exact line. We're going to come back after the break with Lee Papa, the rude pundit, which I think is a bad name for him because, quite frankly, I don't think he's rude. I think he's just a truth teller. But I think rude sells, blog subscriptions, I suppose. That works. It's a good moniker. Anyways, 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'll be taking your calls. We'll be talking about a bunch of this. I would love to hear your take on the solution in Afghanistan. The solution with the oil spill. The solution with the economy. I want to hear your opinions on where we go from here, because that's the important part. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks. We'll be right back with Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, on The Stephanie Miller Show. the Stephanie Miller Show. It's Hal Sparks filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. And, of course, right out of the box, Tony and I are throwing the medal back in. For the record, by the way, I have heard Bill Press use this very song coming in. and that's wrong on two fronts. One is Bill Press is on at Butt in the Morning here in L.A. He's on, I think he comes on at 3:58 in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And then, on the other hand, there's no way he listens to this song. It's, you know, it's kind of like when for research purposes, you listen to somebody like Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh and you listen to their shows, and they always roll with this kind of music. You know what I mean? They'll throw in Nonpoint and Seven Dust and all this stuff, and you know, all this, like the kind of stuff that guys with ponytails and bald spots at NASCAR rallies wearing No Fear T-shirts listen to. And there's no way in 100 years that Rush Limbaugh even knows who the band is or who the heck they are. And it ticks me off a little bit. But that's, speaking of ticked off, I mean he's been waiting long enough. On the phone with us right now is Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit. How are you, sir?
Good, Hal. How are you? I've always been kind of ticked off that Rush Limbaugh totally ruined that Pretender song, My City Was Gone.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like when Dennis Miller, in retrospect, ruined Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears. Great song, and he used to use it for his theme song on his series, on his HBO talk show. And then he became a nudnik psychopath.
Then he was tempted to the dark side.
Yeah. Right. By nothing less than just being a greedy boomer. You know what I mean? It's not even like he's a man of principle. It's just it's the best place to live if you want to complain instead of doing anything.
How many of them? There was that great David Frum article from a few months back where he was, or somebody asked him, you know, who do you think would switch sides if they were paid enough of the conservatives? And he said, Glenn Beck for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Probably O'Reilly. But Limbaugh was probably the only one that wouldn't switch.
Right, because he thinks he's looking at the long money.
Yeah.
That's the only reason he wouldn't. I think he would if there really was the dollar amount long term. I think if he thought it was a fad, it would take him a while.
Yeah.
So we have so much to deal with. I don't even know where to start with you on some of this stuff. I mean, obviously, BP and Transocean and our lovely friends at Halliburton, who've never done a wrong thing in their life, stumbled on this little accident that it could happen to anybody who bribes officials and ignores safety regulations, and now dumping an Exxon Valdez in the ocean every week.
Yeah. I'm from Louisiana, so.
Oh, wow.
So I have a lot of family down there. I have friends that, you know, work on the fishing industry.
So as Mel Gibson would say, you've got a horse in this race.
Yeah, I actually do. I have friends that go out on the rigs. It actually ruined my beach vacation coming up. I'm a redneck Riviera fan, so
right.
It totally screwed up my beach vacation. But anyway, what's going on there is such a human tragedy. We talk so much about the environmental tragedy,
right.
and I think that we sometimes lose sight of the fact that 11 men died,
right?
Also that the psychological effect on the entire culture and population down there. In other words, the fishing boat captain who committed suicide last week. It is literally a couple of centuries of life that is now being wiped out.
Right. It's teetering forever on the brink. Interestingly enough, when Tony Hayward said, "I'd like my life back," I don't know anybody whose mind didn't immediately rush to those 11 workers who were killed on that platform. I mean,
he's out of the picture now, and he should have been out a long time ago. Nobody needed to have Hugh Grant out there, you know, stumbling through the response.
Yeah, but at the same time, quite frankly, he's not been removed from his position.
Right. Right. No, and he's obviously he's done. You know what's interesting is he promised. I think it was in 2007. I think when he was brought on, something like that. He promised that within a couple of years he would raise BP's revenue by $3 billion. But don't worry, we'll still make sure we do it in the safest way possible.
Right.
So he was there promising a huge uptick in profit while still saying, "Don't worry, we're still going to spend."
While cutting costs, and literally, what are we talking about? The cost, what cost do they actually expend besides R&D? Is building giant floating metal platforms in areas of high wind, high seas, hurricanes, and digging deeper than anyone has ever dug before without the technology to shut it off, knowing full well they don't.
Now, Sarah Palin said that if we were willing to dig in shallow waters, if that this wouldn't have happened.
Sure.
Except for, of course, you know, when it happened in the Gulf of Mexico, in a bay in Mexico,
right.
In 1979, in, what was it, 150 feet of water?
Right.
In shallow water?
Yeah.
And that lasted for 9 months?
Yeah. And there's no clearing that out. That's
right.
The, you know, in this case, there is an element of boom and deep water that can shift this situation and make it not horrible. But if this had, because the shelf isn't that far off, by the way. The water gets really deep, not that far from shore. They went further out. It's not just the depth of the water, but they're out in international waters.
Right.
Because of the lightning of this. And I love how, Bobby Jindal and all the Gulf Coast governors are all about these oil rigs, because quite frankly, a lot of people work on them. But they're also smart enough to know they want them far enough away that if anything, that the slow leak that always happens doesn't visually screw up the beach. Because let's be honest, most Americans don't care about pollution they don't see.
Right, right.
As long as it's invisible, L.A.'s air wouldn't have gotten cleaned up. I mean, L.A.'s air in now is an about face from where I moved out here in 1989. And quite frankly, it was brown. You flew through it. It looked chunky. It looked like the sky was made of Dinty Moore beef stew.
Oh, but that was that wonderful time out there when the drought was making everybody not able to flush their toilets.
Right.
It was great.
Oh, the caramel sky, I used to call it.
Yeah.
And then because we saw it all the time, we were under constant panic, and we fixed it. The same thing with syringes and condoms and all kinds of stuff washing up in the Santa Monica Bay. That led to the Heal the Bay movement, which is the most successful bay cleaning organization and charity that's ever existed. The Gulf... Do you think this is going to lead us to the biggest environmental move in our, culturally? Or do you think the GOP is going to hang on that tightly?
I don't think it's just the GOP that's going to hang on that tightly. I mean, I said last week that I think that one of the biggest disappointments was that, Obama made vague promises about what we need to do for the future without pushing our outrage about that very visible degradation of the environment. I mean, again, I think he should have enlisted us more in it as citizens who rely on the Gulf all around the country. I mean, the ripple effect of this hasn't even begun.
Right. I've noticed, and this is something that maybe, a personal thing for him or a campaign-oriented thing, that he does tend to master and push the optimistic side of things much better than the negative side. That most of the negative that came during the campaign against McCain came from the fact that McCain was setting himself up. I mean, if you read, the most recent book on Obama, The Promise. And you talk about how McCain just basically handed that victory to Obama by being an idiot.
Right. Yeah. Well, isn't that the way campaigns go? Isn't that why Scott Brown won in Massachusetts? It's because Martha Coakley ran an idiotic campaign. But you're right.
But he doesn't marshal the negative, is my point.
He
doesn't, the Republicans have been really good for a very long time at using fear as a hammer. And when you run against them as a system, you run on optimism.
The Republicans use fear to tell you to go hide in your hole.
Right.
you can also use fear as a way of saying, no, come out. Let's all get out here and fix it. In other words, it can be the bully that forces everybody into the town in the town to stay inside, or it can be the sheriff that says, do we want to stand for this? Do we all want to come out and chase them out of town?
Exactly. The coward of the county kind of political movement concept. You could have heard a pin drop when Tommy stopped and locked the door, right?
Yeah. Legitimate new political theory.
Right.
There.
And I honestly think that there's a real weird line for Democrats to walk, being as Big Ten as we tend to be and as we want to be, using the fear mallet too much. I think that's where our discomfort with it has come from. I think there's such a narrow window on the GOP side, they have no problem with it. But it is 100% their weapon. There is not a single ounce of hope or promise. That's why the word progressive scares the crap out of them, because the idea of progress, of moving forward, you know, they're used to these tools. This is the only way they know how to work.
Right. No, you're right. They're used to looking backwards. We're used to looking forwards, and they need to scare people away from voting, while we need to get people out there voting.
Right, right. So then the question begs, in a lot of ways, what's your view on where the election is headed this year? I mean, I know some of the polls have recently come out and said, by the way, how are we on time? We're going to take a break. I want to get to this after. I want to talk to you about your sort of prediction or view of how the election might be going. I'm talking to Lee Pop, the Rude Pundit, who is the awesome, as we like to say in the world of Twitter. I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter, you can watch us streaming on halsparks.com/ustream as we speak to Lee Poppett. He's going to stick with us during the break, and we'll be back right after this. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEPH-12. We'll be getting to Dave in Wisconsin in a little bit, who's holding on the line as well. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Ow. I just snarfed oatmeal out my nose. It must be the Stephanie Miller Show.
With Lee Papa, listening to Danko Jones, that magnum opus, that amazing song, The Finger.
That's great.
1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I really do think we found you a theme song. I
appreciate it. I was banging my head on my coffee table, so.
That's a good feeling. It's a good feeling. Yeah, you can't go wrong with Danko Jones. I mean, you know, I bought my first Danko Jones when I was living in Toronto. Doing Queer as Folk, and I was really getting into Canadian rock because they're in many ways they're like 15 years behind us in a good way. You know, they didn't get caught up in new metal and all this kind of like overprocessed crap. They just make music and it's really beautiful.
So they're back at good Metallica.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. And Danko is they're a three piece, and Danko Jones is an actual guy. But when I read the review, I was like looking through bands and stuff, and they have in other countries actually care about their artists, so they'll have the in the sticker thing that they stick in the CD shelf, there'll be a little review. They'll actually put a review like, hey, this might be why you might want to pick it. And they said, the bastard children of Kiss and AC/DC if they had children while sniffing glue. And so I immediately had to buy the Danko Jones record based on that review. Excuse me, I'm going to be coughing intermittently, but I'm not pushing the cough button. I'm just going to ride it out. This is rock and roll. Lee Papa is with us. It's Lee, it's rudepundit.blogspot.com.
RudePunditblogspot.com, and I'm also on the Twitter too at @RudePundit.
@RudePundit. So yes, be sure to not only follow, but follow Friday him. You know, toss that name around. Enjoy the gifts that Lee Papa will throw your way, but also pass them on to your friends and family by adding him to your Follow Friday.
I like to think of them as little acid tablets or little ecstasy tablets of wisdom.
Right. Yes, that's a spectacular way of viewing it. Do you mind if we take a couple of calls? I'd love to have you interacting with the folks, the peeps.
Sure.
A couple of people have been hanging on for a little bit. Dave in Madison, Wisconsin, wants to talk about the spill. Dave, you there?
Yeah, I am. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, you guys are great. And if you go to B-Side Records in Madison, you can get little vignettes or little write-ups on each of the CDs as well. I just wanted to say, Hal, you brought up something that is very, very important. I don't know if you know, you're an evolutionary biologist. Mm-hmm. The idea of out of sight, out of mind, where BP wants to keep the dead animals and the visual oil off the beaches, away from the public eye,
right,
is, you know, we all get that, but there's an evolutionary underpinning to that. Marketers have figured it out. And polluters and those who are doing things, Bush figured it out very well when he kept the coffins from the public eye. What people don't see, smell, taste, touch, and hear, they pay less attention to than what they do. And it's called sensory discounting, and it underlies so many of the problems that we're having. And that is at the heart of BP's
strategy.
Cynical and disgusting strategy.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And that's an excellent point. I accidentally, by the way, dropped Lee when I was, because I'm new at working these phones. I apologize for that. I've got to put a lock hold on you whenever I do that, and so now I have you locked in. You're not going anywhere, my friend.
That's so tempting, Hal.
Yes. but the point he was trying to make is that BP, much like the Bush administration with the coffins coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, made a point to create an out-of-sight, out-of-mind methodology. And that's really what it takes. I kind of had this realization, and perhaps you may agree or disagree with it. It seems to me that in this day and age, if you can weather something for 20 days, you can get all the way through it without any damage being done to you whatsoever. That it's 20 days seems to be the arc of vitriol, and it never goes further than that, no matter how horrible, from torture to, the good and bad of trying to get Sonia Sotomayor in. There were these 20-day arcs.
If even that long at times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the thing that BP has to face, though, is that they've got an entire summer of people standing on beaches that they want to go swimming in and watching tar balls and oil patches come in.
Right.
And so this is, you can't imagine this. I mean, the public relations nightmare for them, which they well deserve, is just going to be ongoing for months and months.
Well, and also,
even past when the relief well is drilled, and let's not forget that when a hurricane drags a good chunk of that oil in with it, they can try to put up the blinders and prevent media access, but you know pelicans fly,
right,
or stumble around.
Well, in the horrible, I mean. Let's not forget my big fear from this, which is flaming oil tornadoes. This is when hurricanes come ashore and flaming oil tornadoes hit the earth. The Bible spoke of pillars of fire. This may actually be it.
If I'm going to go out,
that's a way to go.
Flaming tornado. It's better than civilization dying because of derivatives changing.
I totally agree.
A flaming tornado taking out my town, that would be incredible.
Oh, I'd be on a surfboard with oven mitts on, trying to ride it as far and as long as I could.
I'd be standing there in a hot dog suit.
So I'm going to we're coming up against a hard break. It's the top of the hour. I know normally at this point we lose you, Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit. But I would implore you to, if you would like, to stick around and take a couple calls now that I'm capable of taking calls into the top of the next hour for at least the first break, so we can actually get people to interact with you out there in the world and see why that they should be following at Rude Pundit on Twitter and going to rudepundit.blogspot.com. Can you make that happen?
You bet.
Fantastic. I am Hal Sparks. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. We've got some calls we'll get to right after the at the top of the hour. There's so many things that we need to do to deal with. I mean, I could solve them by the end of the week, not by the end of the show. But I'm fairly certain I could solve all these problems by the end of the week. But you have to keep listening. 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm Hal Sparks. This is the Stephanie Miller Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning to you. This is Hal Sparks filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. The show is going swimmingly and largely due to the fact that our guest today, Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, rudepundit.blogspot.com, is with us. Lee, you there? Can I hear you? There you go.
Hello.
There you are. Hiya. So I wanted to I was going over a couple of your blogs because I really wanted to bring up a couple of them. One was your your blog after the replacement of McChrystal with Petraeus was a spot on and really nicely played. Obviously, the great thing about your work is a it's nice to have you on here, but we can't actually quote you on the air because of quite frankly why you're known as the Rude Pundit.
Stephanie hits the beep button a number of times.
Yes, I don't actually have that today. She took her little box with her. Usually, Steph
as
is nice
well
enough.
She should.
Yeah, well, you know, oddly enough, most of the time when she leaves her box behind. Doesn't really use it when she's on vacation, apparently.
Maybe she wants you to have it for a while.
Oh, that's romantic. I like the sound of that. But I don't think that's the case. I don't know why she didn't leave her box for me this time. But there's no box here. And so I can't beep you out. So we're just going to have to need to go to rudepundit.blogspot.com or follow you on Twitter, and they can find that link just by going to your Twitter page, I'm sure. But your post on the 24th entitled Release the Petraeus essentially makes a fantastic case that by replacing McChrystal with Petraeus, he inoculated himself against any war criticism from any of his Republican rivals going into 2012. He basically gutted them and nutted them and left them kind of with nothing to say.
Oh, yeah. He not only did that, but he took out what probably would have been the best possible, if he had run, the best possible candidate against him on the Republican side.
Right.
There is nobody across, I haven't heard anyone across the political spectrum say that this was, I think that people on the right were stunned, like, oh, man, we got outwitted again.
Right.
And it really was, because I didn't see that coming. You know, everybody thought Petraeus was there, in his role in Central Command, but it really was one of those times you sat back and went, all right, maybe he really is a dozen steps ahead of us.
Right.
And also
it seems like one of those decisions that's made during the Truman era or the Roosevelt era. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those decisions where that looked very historical in its context. Because of its wisdom and because of its, both politically and strategically. Obviously, you know, you and I probably have our same issues with coin.
Right. Yeah.
But that being said, if you're going to push that strategy, having one of the authors of it pushing it is always better than having, I guess, the military's equivalent of Danny Bonaducci running it.
Well, I mean, you know, he was McChrystal, you know, although to all reports, politically, you know, fairly left wing. I mean, he was a special ops guy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you wanted somebody that was going to run an operation that was just going to go and, you know, knife Al Qaeda in the night,
right.
I assume we have going on too.
Of course.
Then he was your man. But you know, he was somebody who believed above in the power of the military above anything else, and so there was no way that he was going to be a good representative of this strategy, even though he subscribed to it and, you know, sort of also was one of the authors of the strategy.
Right. You know, also, there's an issue with him, and one of the ways that they pointed out that he was a good commander was that he would, you know, in a couple of instances, he went and directly went on the ground and went on point with some troops who had a problem with him.
Right.
Which, on the one hand, it sounds theoretically like a great thing, you know, that he's just that down with the troops. But also, I think it may point, in his case, with where ego was definitely at play, at a sort of, you know, untouchable element.
Yeah.
And that kind of permeated his decisions as well.
Right.
And when he's, referring to, you know, his staff is referring to meetings with the French ambassador as gay and, you know, and like clearly this kind of, you know, roughly boys club. There's a problem there in going, okay, I'm sending a guy to, put this strategy in place, and he thinks he's bulletproof.
Yep, yep. And let's not forget, though, that Michael Hastings, the author of the Rolling Stone article.
Yeah.
You know, this is a guy who shamed so many other reporters, reporters who thought that their job was to be part of the club instead of to be antagonistic to the club. And, it was brave and he's that old style reporter you used to see in movies, you know, on the front page,
yeah.
And sitting there slugging back whiskey and then telling the stories that need to be told.
Right. You know, he, interestingly enough, I was talking to David Bender, who will be a guest with us on Thursday, brilliant guy, in many ways referred to as, you know, as Rachel Maddow's political guru, very bright, been in this for a long time. And he was telling me about Hastings in particular, of course, was a Newsweek columnist there as well. And there's a big play to paint him as strictly Rolling Stone, if you'll notice, from the right when, during this part, because the idea is that Rolling Stone is a bunch of hippies, you know.
Right, right.
And, but he actually wasn't really in a position to write this article on McChrystal. He was doing kind of a, you know, a minor short story on them. But they all got grounded at the same time,
yep.
Because of the volcano. And he ended up having to take a bus with McChrystal and his gang across Germany and up into Europe. And he had no... They basically all got drunk on the bus and started talking. And then suddenly... They felt comfortable around him enough to open up, and he was with them now for a big stretch of time and was able to write something of substance. And
right.
And the interesting thing is, and I think it's a brilliant point you bring up, that he, while they accepted him as part of the club, he used that as a legitimate access as a reporter,
yeah.
And reported what he actually saw, and no more.
And if they didn't start a conversation by saying it's off the record, it's not off the record, you know?
Right.
And I think that the initial way McChrystal played it was, okay, if there was one thing that McChrystal did in this whole thing, it was he at least manned up and said, okay, he
yeah.
did it. You know, he takes and he was given responsibility for it. He was fired for it because
right.
he had to be, but at least he didn't come out with some kind of, you know, wimpy public statement saying, you know, I was taken out of context.
Right.
I thought I trusted him. Blah blah blah. No, it was you screwed up. And
you know, quite frankly, it occurred to me in reading the article that McChrystal strikes me as not quite. Jack Nicholson's character in A Few Good Men.
Right.
You need me on that wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, I do that so that you can sleep at night. You know, you can't handle the truth kind of moment. But McChrystal, I think, is not quite that character. I think he's referential to that character and is excited by the idea of being that character.
And it was very clearly demonstrated that he was replaceable and he wasn't the person that we needed there. And I really hope that Biden was there and on the way out, Biden said, "Nah, bite me."
Yeah, right. Totally. it's a fascinating turn. And like I said, I think it has a tremendous amount of historical context. Mm-hmm. It reeks of a World War I, World War II type of decision. And I think that I find that very reassuring. As bad as Afghanistan is, and as stupid as it seems, and as much as we always feel like we're having to give benefit of the doubt to the people who are running this kind of situation, because quite frankly, there's no way for us to know everything that's about it. I mean, we all can gather quite a bit of information, and it certainly doesn't help when, you know, sergeants and generals are coming out and going, "We're losing this thing, and there's no point to be here," and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I think it makes me feel a little more patient with his decisions because of this, because this seemed so smart.
I don't believe in the strategy,
right.
And I think that the strategy is to be there endlessly and as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, to chase down 50 to 100
right, which is an absurdity. Yeah,
and then also deal with the Taliban so that that Al Qaeda can't have this supposed safe haven, even though it's not really their safe haven. It's just the porous borders that are connected by caves or mountains or whatever.
Which were not borders to start with. They're
right.
Borders set up by the British and the Allies and us.
Right.
During a big stretch of time where we, you know, as Eddie Izzard would say, we captured a bunch of countries using a clever use of flags.
Yes.
You know, but there was, you know, these are, you know, Pashtun regions and nomadic tribesmen, basically. This is where the burqa and all that stuff comes from, you know, as a cultural element, is because you got people rolling through and you don't know them. So you cover all your daughters with a tarp so nobody can tell who's who. You know, this is a different mentality.
I just wondered how many, in counting that 100 Al-Qaeda members, I wonder, is he saying that there's like 100 violent ones? Because are some of them like cooks or goat wranglers?
Well, that's exactly it, right.
Brothels.
Are they 100 really high-up guys, the ones that we have to worry about that are basically the CEO and CFO of the entire organization?
I tend to think there's like three of them. And then, you know, number three is like the guy in the
like
red
Pez
shirt
dispenser.
On Star Trek.
Right.
Who it's like, all right, you're next.
Yeah.
Let's rotate.
Ensign Johnson, right. No,
yeah.
I don't want to go. I'm going to die.
Oh, no. You're going to make me go down to get new audio tape for the cave recorder Osama?
Right.
Oh.
Yeah, for the third dummy Osama bin Laden who's been killed this week.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's, by the way, the French have said he's been dead for 3 years, so... There you go. And I love how they said that all during the Bush administration. And then the Bush administration, well, the rest of the world thought that they had weapons of mass destruction. Well, the rest of the world is also giving you intelligence that's saying that Osama bin Laden and a lot of those guys have been dead for a long time. You don't take that seriously.
No. Because cave dialysis is an easy thing to
totally.
Do.
Totally. It's a solar-powered dialysis machine. He invented it. You know, interestingly enough, I think he could make enough money that he wouldn't have to be a terrorist anymore if he'd really...
Or just go to his dad.
Exactly. Thank you so much for hanging with us, Lee, today. Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, at Rude Pundit on the Twitter. And, of course, rudepundit.blogspot.com. Everybody in our Ustream chat room at housesparks.com/Ustream, make sure you race over there and give him a hit and a hug and add him to your Follow Friday list. Thank you so much for sticking around and giving your perspective. And I recommend that everybody go over there and actually give his stuff a read if the saucy language doesn't bother you. Yeah. Thanks so much, Lee.
All right, thanks a lot, Hal.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers. We are up against a break, so I'll be back in just a moment. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12. We'll be getting to your calls right after this. For the next the whole rest of the hour, I'm going to be taking calls from you guys on these very issues: Afghanistan, the oil crisis. These are situations that seem unsolvable. But I know there's a lot of smart people out there, myself included, and we all have a lot of ideas on how to make them happen. And I want to hear some of yours. And I'm going to tell you some of the ones that are actually coming down the pike, both politically and from the private sector, that you may or may not agree with. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
On the Stephanie Miller radio show in suburban America this morning.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
This is the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in. This is a song that Tony really wanted to play coming back from the break, which I really love as well. It's called Creeping Death, which I think is a good, you know, when you're talking about the oil spill, kind of an excellent one to use. Let's go to Barry in New York City. Barry, you there?
Good morning, Hal.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm soldiering through with my voice.
Yeah,
but
I think... I know Stephanie... didn't leave her box here, so.
Yeah, that's sad. I don't have Stephanie's box to play with.
Maybe she left it with her beaver.
It's entirely possible. There's no beaver here either.
Oh,
I've looked.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah.
I was hoping to catch Rude on the phone because I got a great theme song for him. I thought he could use John Lennon's Just Give Me Some Truth.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
And but actually, the reason why I called was those opposed to stopping global warming said that there's no global mm-hmm. warming. They said that this winter was so cold and there were lots of storms, so there's no global warming. And,
right.
You know, first of all, weather isn't global warming, which they don't really understand either.
Right.
And obviously, we can't use one season as an example of climate change. But I live in New York City, and June here has been like August usually in New York.
Right.
I don't know. These people are not intellectually curious or politically curious. So how do we reach them?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing that you bring up, but I thank you for the call. I'll kind of address that. Is that I think, quite frankly, you know, there's a big movement on the right that says that climate change is real, but it's natural. It's just the Earth goes through phases. And, you know, it's just going to – the water's going to rise like Al Gore says it is, but not because of Hummers. It's going to happen because, you know, God wants it to be that way. Well, okay, if that is the case and you truly believe that, why are you not down in Florida waving a flag telling people to move to Montana where they won't drown? Because it's not about whether or not for you it's man-made or not. You think it's actually happening, it's just a natural process. Well, if you believe that, then why don't you care enough to try to save people who are going to be at the effect, like you would if you knew that a volcano was going to erupt and people were building condos at the base of it? I'll tell you why. Because you don't care. The whole argument on the right against climate change is an argument for the status quo. It has nothing to do with any concept of weather or any concept of how we should use our resources other than the fact that we should just be left alone to do whatever we want with whatever we have. Let me try to get to Lars in Albuquerque. Lars, you there?
Yes, sir. Hello, Hal. Good show.
Hiya. Thank you, brother.
You said earlier that you'd like people to call in with solutions, and I've got this burning, you know, solution. Well, it's not my solution or anything, but, you know, the recruitment with Al-Qaeda, you know, if you can just stop it right there,
mm-hmm.
that seems to be the best thing. You know, as Ben Franklin said, you know, ounce of prevention beats a pound of cure.
Right.
So, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of a young man in a third world country with really not that much outlook toward the normal things, you know, a guy wants when he's young, you know, thinking about finding a nice woman and starting a family and being able to support them. Well, if that looks pretty bleak, then you look at what are the other opportunities. And if they see that they can join some group and, you know, if they're going to go down in a long, futile life of blazes that's just going to hurt forever, or if they can just go down in one huge triumphant blaze, you know, and some kind of a warrior, then they might want to choose that because they get the 72 virgins and every, you know, the whole nine.
Well, it becomes
yards.
A genuine option, whether they get that stuff or not. How many of us could watch our entire village or families destroyed time and time again and not feel like, I've got nothing but rocks to throw, but I could strap bombs to myself and really take the fight to the enemy. And there's a lot of examples. And we're up against the hard break, but I thank you for the call. It's an excellent point. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. We will be talking a little bit after the break about basically how corporations have gotten into a situation where they are essentially untouchable. And the fight coming up in this election is the fight between corporations and individuals. Is it hard and clean? No. But is it definitive? Absolutely. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number, but right now I am lucky enough to have with me Eric Bollert, Senior Fellow at Media Matters. Eric, are you there?
I am.
Fantastic. First of all, I have to say that people need to rush immediately to Media Matters and read your articles, because not only are they informative and very add a lot of clarity to some murky issues, but you're very funny. And one of the things that one of my favorite ones that you recently wrote was daring the LA Times Andrew Malcolm to blog about Palin's latest poll numbers, which are crap.
Yes.
And are consistently crap.
Inconsistent.
And have been crap for a very long time. And it must be maddening for this kind of nonsense. I mean, literally, they keep showing her again and again as if she's a legitimate candidate, and even on her own side, she's nowhere near a legitimate force.
No, it's been amazing. I mean, the polling, it's funny, you know, the Beltway Press Corps, you know, were obsesses over polling, and basically, you know, that drives, you know, most of the narratives, who's hot, who's not, you know, the polling numbers tell us everything.
Right.
Except when it comes to Sarah Palin.
Right.
You know, we're coming up on the anniversary of her resignation, and in the year that she...
Do we have a name for that holiday yet? Has anybody won the contest?
Somebody ought to. The half-term something or other.
Yeah, it's All Quitters Day?
Right, right.
It'd be a good one.
So in the 12 months since then, the polling has just been absolutely consistent. I mean, it's just been amazing. Mm-hmm. In what low regard most Americans hold Palin as a politician, as a potential leader.
And as a human being.
And as you mentioned, even her, you know, even Republican voters tell pollsters that no.
Yeah.
You know, we're not interested in Sarah Palin as being president or much of anything. But for the last year, I mean, the press has just put that all to the side and just, you know, heaped on a huge amount of attention and traffic and things like that, because I think she is sort of a political catnip, and, you know, she'll get the traffic and she'll get the ratings. And so she has become sort of this entertainment entity, has nothing to do with politics, really, nothing to do with public policy.
So essentially she's a...
Entertainment.
Yeah, essentially she's the Paris Hilton of politics.
She is, and the press has turned her into that. And she's also been able to not give a serious interview in at least a year, I mean, other than, you know, cheerleaders of Fox News. She refuses to deal with the working press. And instead of being sort of offended or pushing back, you know, they treat her Facebook page as a news dispatch.
Right. It's
so
the new drudge.
She's got them right where they want them. They're willingly play along in this game, and it's just really sad to watch. Again, when a new batch of polling comes out, you're like, wow, people like her even less than I thought.
Right. And yet, like I said, there's this consistency, and it must be maddening in your position, because you're monitoring a lot of this stuff, and you're really setting it up against both historical context and general context elsewhere. I mean, the idea of Joe Biden being on TV as much as Sarah Palin and being quoted equally as much is an absurdity. Let's be no qualms about it. There's no way that Joe Biden would be on TV as much as Sarah Palin by instigation of the media.
Right. If he had lost, right. Or, I mean, when Dan Quayle lost as vice president, I mean,
yeah.
We've never had a losing vice presidential candidate that anyone cared about.
Even as a winner, his poll numbers sink hers 100 times over. If you ever put them up against each other as human beings and going, this person versus that person, that you want this person a heartbeat away from the presidency. You want this person. He would trounce her 1,000 times, but he couldn't get, as vice president of the country, the active vice president, could not be taken with as much gravitas and seriousness. It's silly. Like, the only attention he gets is when a member of his family is ill or passes away. They could care less.
Right, that's right.
Even when he's right.
And a lot of the Palin stuff has come through via her attachment to the Tea Party movement, which particularly last spring and over the winter, I mean, the Beltway press just wildly exaggerated the importance of and inflated the importance of. And so, you know, she was attached to that, so they really gave her way too much credit as, you know, supposedly leading this huge, you know, national movement. And then, you know, at tax day, she shows up for an outdoor rally in Boston, and like 4,000 or 5,000 people show up. I mean, you can get high school football crowds that are bigger than
right.
that. And we've seen over the summer, you know, these Tea Party rallies have virtually disintegrated.
Right. Yeah, they've diminished.
And in an odd way, I think the arrival of the BP oil disaster has basically eliminated any momentum that the Tea Party movement had.
That's true.
Because they refuse to take on big business and big oil.
Their handlers don't. Even if they did, that would be the place where they would ultimately part ways with the parts that were genuinely not your grassroots.
That's right. And what did Rand Paul say after the BP spill? Well, you know, basically accidents happen, and
right.
it seems almost un-American to be going after BP. But the press gave Palin way too much credit because they thought she was the leader of this huge, you know, tsunami political movement that was the Tea Party. And then it turns out, as we see more and more, there's no there in terms of the Tea Party movement. Yes, Republicans are probably going to do well in the midterms. But this idea that, you know, Sarah Palin is out leading the charge, it doesn't really hold up. So, you know, I think she benefited from that, and I think she benefited from the fact that she drives, like I said, ratings and traffic. And this is, she's the perfect crystallization of how the Beltway press would prefer to cover politics as entertainment, and just do away with the public policy stuff and just cover everything as sort of a partisan bickering match. And Palin plays the perfect role for that.
Right. And in and kind of dovetailing into another thing that's kind of been going on throughout is that, you know, she and Huckabee are both on Fox News and the two essential polling front runners, as bad as those numbers are.
That's right.
With the GOP, are now essentially Fox News personalities.
Oh, absolutely. And it was interesting over the weekend. Huckabee took a couple of shots at Sarah Palin via Fox News, suggesting
Romney.
Yeah, and he would not sign off the idea that, you know, she is qualified. So, yeah, I mean, basically, you know, the green room at Fox News is doubling as sort of the primary season. And we always knew that was going to happen because Fox News has morphed into, you know, the opposition party. They are the kingmakers. They're going to decide who the next, candidate's going to be.
Partly because they don't want to compete with, you know, that they know they're competing with Rush Limbaugh for who that person is, and they want the credit.
That's
right. Ultimately, if he picks the person and they, you know, run away with it or do well, then Fox is diminished slightly and has to follow his lead.
That's right. So they were going to have this sort of intramural right-wing media war to pick the next nominee. And right, but Huckabee's cashing a Fox News check. Sarah Palin's cashing a Fox News check. And it's, you know, again, it just completely crystallizes how Fox News is now the opposition party.
Right. And what's the foot soldier version of Fox's on the ground movement, which is largely a militia style attitude towards how things should be carried out. I mean, literally, you know, most of the people that they're kind of appealing to on a grassroots level tend to be wearing, you know, Benjamin Franklin outfits and carrying muskets, you know, they're, you know, like toys, but are meant to be, show how serious they are. And this kind of cartoon idea of what it's like to actually run a government.
Right.
We're gonna stage a coup essentially by being idiots with guns in a park.
Well, I mean, that, now we're talking to Glenn Beck's audience.
I mean,
definitely he is tapping into this sort of naive and sort of lunatic idea about what the founding fathers really were, and spreading sort of all sort of hate conspiracies about how liberals have been trying to ruin this country since the 18th century and et cetera. And, yeah, I mean, he is sort of tapping into this patriot fever of you know, if you're going to save the your country, now's the time to do it. Otherwise, you know, Obama's going to wreck it from within.
Right.
So, yeah, and, you know, he's got his big August 28th event at the
Lincoln
Memorial,
right,
which he has claimed, A, he has basically been told by God to do it, and, B, it's going to change the course of human history. So
this is going
to
be awesome.
Setting the bar kind of high.
I'm excited. I got to say, I'm excited to see it.
And the best part is he's going to hire his own firm to do crowd estimates, because he doesn't trust
the fire department,
the parks department, and the press. Because last time the Tea Party folks came to D.C., there were only 60,000, and they claimed there were 2 million.
Right.
So they're going to hire someone to say, oh, by the way, there were
2 million people here. Look at this picture of 30. We stacked them together.
That's right. And it's all part of this parallel universe. It's the whole point of this, you know, particularly Fox News, et cetera, is to create your own parallel right-wing universe where you don't really have to agree on any kind of fact. You don't have to agree that there were only 60,000 people in D.C. There are actually 2 million. So it's sort of this ongoing, continuous effort to create sort of their own set of facts and their own parallel universe. You know, I personally think that's why Rasmussen exists. So, you know, they can have these very Republican-friendly polling numbers, so they don't have to read Gallup or the ABC numbers that are different. So they have their own polling, they have their own media, they have their own crowd estimates, and they're just sort of putting the final touches on this little bubble that they're going to live in full time.
Right, and it pops repeatedly, but they don't seem to care.
No, they don't mind. No.
They run on faith anyways most of the time.
Oh, you will still hear regular references to the 2 million people that showed up in D.C. last September. That is a fact. You cannot. The fact that they're off by 1.93 million people is irrelevant.
Well, you know what my favorite new Fox News term is?
What's that?
Fact spread. That when you operate and you're pushing a story from Fox's newsroom, they operate what they call a fact spread, where they'll take certain facts that work in their favor, eliminate other facts that don't, and push the ones that really enforce what they want,
right,
and deny or hide the ones that don't, so that there's no parity in the, you know, balance in the conversation at all.
That's right. It's always a one-sided conversation.
It's all about the fact spread. That's great. We got to take a break. Would you mind sticking with me over this break real quick?
And then, sure.
And because there's a couple of things I also want to kind of along those lines. I mean, it's almost a never-ending pool, but we're going to take a break. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph, on the line with Eric Bollert. He's going to stick with us, and we'll talk to him right after the break. Senior fellow at MediaMatters.org. We'll be right back.
Makes me sick in a wonderful, wonderful way.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. On the line with me, blissfully, wonderfully hanging on with us, Eric Bollert from Media Matters. One of the things I wanted to kind of get to, and where we were sort of headed with our first dissection of the amazing media explosion that is Sarah Palin, without, you know, the all light, no heat aspect of her her political future, and then followed immediately by, of course, Glenn Beck's desire to be sort of a slightly more racist and psychotic Alex Jones. Like, take Alex Jones to a religious nutcase level. Followed immediately by the fact that Fox News as an organization threw all their weight behind BP.
Yeah.
In this, and has been really, I mean, this is definitely a top-down decision that's been made.
It's amazing. I mean, I think the Wall Street Journal, NBC report asked people what they felt of their opinion of BP, and it was a 6% favorable, which was right up there with Saddam Hussein on the eve of the Iraq War. But the sort of Obama derangement syndrome that drives Fox News,
right,
drove it sort of over the cliff to basically embrace BP and defend BP. Because the model has always been, if Obama does something, it's evil and un-American and has to be opposed. So the stimulus package was evil, and bailing out the auto companies was evil and un-American. And so when Obama helped secure $20 billion in compensation for the oil spill,
mm-hmm,
Fox News looked at that and decided, of course, that's evil and un-American, and Obama has to be attacked for that.
Right.
So we really saw this just amazing picture play out, where Fox is just relentlessly attacking the Obama administration for helping to secure $20 billion in compensation. BP had been bullied. There had been a shakedown and all of this. And again, another poll I saw, 82% of Americans supported the creation of this $20 billion escrow fund. And the other interesting part is no one from BP has ever suggested that they were the victim of a shakedown or had been bullied,
right,
by the Obama White House. Fox News just concocted this out of thin air. Because,
mm-hmm,
again, if Obama does it, it's got to be wrong, even if it's helping the people in the Gulf who are suffering.
Even if their viewers agree with it. Because, it's one of those things like, we tell you the news, you decide. That's one of their big kind of pushes. But if you craft the amount of information coming out, they assume the decision you're going to make is going to match the one they had in mind in the
first place. That's
again,
right.
The facts spread.
That's right.
As it were.
And again, when Obama won the Nobel Prize, he won it, therefore it must be bad. When America lost the Olympic bid for Chicago last year, which Obama pushed for, it's because that must have been a good thing. So, the right wingers celebrated, America losing the Olympics. America, the right wingers condemned the Nobel Prize because the American president won it. BP, is destroying the Gulf of Mexico, which Obama opposes. Therefore, Fox News sort of supports BP. I mean, it's just
right.
Crazy. And I was sort of wondering, and I admitted I was being sort of naive in the column I wrote last week, is Fox News sort of at the tipping point where the fact that they're supporting BP of all people.
Right.
You really have to wonder, how much further can they go?
We both know, too, that, News Corp is quarter owned by a Saudi prince.
That's right.
Who Glenn Beck actually referred to as, a terrorist at one point, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They don't like to talk about that kind of
thing. No, they don't like to talk about it. But the point being is that I think the BP situation goes even further than their own Obama derangement syndrome in that that's a pocketed thing. They're gonna go with that side of it. And corporations, to some degree, they know. And that, I think, you can also take as solace if you're an Obama supporter, that one of the reasons why they don't like him so much is because they know, given enough room, he will come for all those people that put money in their pockets.
Yeah.
And so they have to watch him. They have to chip away at anything he does as if it's, the actions of the Antichrist, so that we only get these kind of 80% situations or 60% situations. And that's what they're really hoping for, because they know, left to his own devices, a lot of what's going to happen is going to directly affect their backers, their pocketbooks, their corporate handlers.
Yeah, and just the idea that, it's amazing, the right wing and Limbaugh and others, they still sort of worship at the altar of big business.
Right.
I mean, to them, the CEOs and the executives who run big business, who run big oil, still have all the answers, even though BP can't plug this hole.
Right.
So still given the choice between, the government and BP, It's a complete hypocrisy because for weeks, you know, Fox News was deriding Obama for why hasn't the government stopped this oil spill? And then when the government holds BP responsible to the tune of $20 billion, they turn around saying, where does the government get off the nerve telling BP what to do?
Shaking down a private corporation and telling them what you do. Instead of saying, okay, these guys might try to claim bankruptcy in the middle of all this and leave us all hanging. So what we're going to do is, in the middle of this, we're going to make sure that that you guys put some money into this fund right now.
Right. I mean, the escrow made perfect sense. The Americans supported it. It actually stabilized the stock, the BP stock, because investors now understood, you know, in a general sense, what the damages were going to look like. You know, only a lunatic would suggest it was a bad thing. And Fox News, right, for an entire week did exactly that.
It's fantastic. This is legitimately, this is now the GOP. This is the machine work of the GOP.
It's the party of BP.
Exactly. Eric Bullard, senior fellow at Media Matters, MediaMatters.org. Thank you so much for being with us today. Are you on the Twitter, my friend, by the way?
I am, yes. The Eric Bullard.
There you go.
There you go.
At Eric Bullard, B-O-E-H-L-E-R-T for those at home. And I'll put that in the chat room at HowlSparks.com/Ustream. Thanks so much for being with us. It's an amazingly, the amount of muck you have to go through to do your job, I do not wish on my worst enemy. That's not true. I actually wish it on some of the people at Fox. I wish they had to look at their own comments and go, oh my God, I said that? Thank you so much for calling in. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. We will be right back at the top of the hour taking your calls. 1-800-STEPH-12. It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's The Stephanie Miller Show.
It feels so good right here. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. So grateful that you could join us. We have a bunch of calls on the line, so I want to get to everybody. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Let's go to I'm going to try to get everybody in the order that they called in. Let's go to Sanchez in Montebello. Are you there?
Senor Sparks.
Hey, Senor Sanchez. How are you?
And a shout-out to Tony, too, by the way. Are you in the L.A. studio or are you in New York?
Oh, we're in L.A.
Oh, geez, Tony has the lock to pick Mamacita's box. I'm sure you might have access
to
that.
It's not here. We looked.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, no. Believe me, whenever I'm in the studio, we look for Steph's box.
Oh, my God, and she took the liquor with her, too, then.
Yeah.
Oh, bummer. Hey, I wanted to offer not a defense, but an explanation as to what you and Rude Pundit were discussing over McChrystal and Michael Hastings being able to get the story over the other reporters. Let me quickly draw a parallel. Remember back before, like, say, 1980, reporters who were reporting on Congress or any of the politicians were willing to overlook, in particular, JFK's sexual peccadilloes in order to stay on the beat, in order to maintain access to the subjects. Unfortunately, this is the case with the military reporters versus somebody who's a freelancer like Michael Hastings, who was able to drop in, grab a story, and then move on. He doesn't have to worry about future access to the military generals. And most of the time, these military people feel comfortable hanging around all of these regular reporters.
The embedded.
Yes, there you go, the embedded reporters. Now, I'm not defending this action because obviously McChrystal had some pretty severe views here, or extreme. But at the same time, as an explanation, that's why most of those other beat reporters, because what's going to happen now as a result of this, probably the direction's coming down from the Pentagon telling all of these people in the military to shut up and, you know, to close up. So it's, what I'm hearing is a complaint from a lot of the beat reporters is, well, we're probably not going to have access like we used to for, say, the next 6 months or so. But there's one thing that I did want to agree with Rude Pundit about one one thing. Mm-hmm. He feels that there's going to be an increase, a surge in troops in Afghanistan. I tend to think the same way. I think we're going to have a surge as opposed to a pullout.
I don't think you're that far off. I don't think it'll be a massive one, though. I think, originally there was this, this jockeying back and forth between, is it 60,000 troops? Is it, we ended up with 30,000? Is it 40,000? That's the magic number. the difference was, they wanted to go in, when they asked for this spread initially, this group, they wanted to put in these extra soldiers in kind of a generic spread.
Yeah.
Add extra forces to each initial place.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is, in certain areas, an extra 10 soldiers makes the difference between life and death. And in other areas, an extra 10 soldiers doesn't matter at all. And the way they were pushing this spread was kind of a generic thing because the idea was to hold the whole area.
Correct.
Obama wants to get out, so when he went back and said, you can have 30,000, and you got to tell me where they're going, what they're doing. And one of the reasons why the death toll has gone up, and the reason, which is the hard part to talk about in this, is because so is the fighting. So is the actual instigation. We've been sitting in that place.
Yeah.
Doing next to nothing except endangering our soldiers' lives. Most of the deaths originally, for the last, 8 years have come from IEDs and the like.
Right.
And now they're coming from shots fired.
Yes.
And the reason they're coming from shots fired is because we're actually implementing a strategy and actually fighting a war.
Well,
As bad as that is, it's actually what you're supposed to be doing if you actually believe what you're selling.
Yeah, one other thing that might lend credence to our belief that there may possibly be an escalation is Senator Carl Levin released a press statement over the weekend here saying that we should put a hold on the actions in Kandahar. And that, to me, translates into maybe we should hold all the troops, maybe do a little surge, but hold this back until next year when we can regroup. I mean,
they've already pushed the big fighting off to the fall.
Yeah.
There's no question. And that's partly a weather thing. There's all kinds of factors going in over there. It's a very hot part of the world, and it's there are different elements that go into play when you're moving troops in and out, when you're moving gear in and out, that kind of stuff. And they do these big intensives. And the truth is, what that also shows you is that area is not changing much over time.
Good point here. There was a question I asked John Fugelsang on Friday, and I might as well ask you the same question. After all the discussion on Afghanistan over the past few weeks, why do you suppose nobody has been mentioning the Afghanistan poppy fields, man?
Well, I mean, because if you look at the CIA's history,
yes,
operating in other countries using that as a commodity to buy and sell influence. That's a big reason why.
Yeah.
The second reason is because it's a humanitarian, it's one of the biggest marks that was against McChrystal, quite frankly, because under his watch over the last couple of years, they've gone from 3% of the populace using to somewhere between 7 and 14% of the populace.
Yes.
A tripling at the very least, and a sextupling at the worst, and that's... I mean, by comparison, you're looking at, Pakistan, a neighboring country, with a 1.5 to 2%.
Yeah.
Which has actually gone down in that amount of time. The same access, same porous borders, same poppy fields, all that stuff, usage goes down. But the war-torn areas of Afghanistan, how horribly this is affecting people, is a big part of this. So the usage is up. The other thing, too, is... it's a commodity we use. The drug money, in a lot of ways, had a lot of factors of keeping our economy afloat. If you'll notice, this is one of my favorite things, and then I want to take somebody else's call, but I want to get to this point, is that, remember pre-9/11, and shortly thereafter, they would ask you the three questions, and everybody joked about the three questions. This was actually after the first bombing of the World Trade Center. They started asking you the silly questions about your bags. Did you pack this bag yourself? Did anybody give you anything to carry, and have your bags been in your sight the whole time?
Yeah.
Okay. Those series of questions have nothing to do with bombs.
Yeah.
Never did. They're about drugs. They are a pre-Miranda admission of guilt in the event that they find drugs in your bag. Because what are the three things that people say when they find a brick of heroin in their bag? I put my bag down. Anybody could have put that there.
Yeah.
This guy handed me that and said, to carry it on. That's I didn't pack my bags. Dave packed my bags. This is what this is for. When it's a bomb, that never works in. That has nothing to do with anything. Nobody ever claims that there's not an intricately wired bomb in the lining of a bag they didn't know about.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the people who blow themselves up claim credit whether it works or not.
Yeah.
These questions were about drugs.
Yeah.
As soon as bombs became a real issue, those questions went away for two reasons. One is, it's not as important as bombs. So
yeah,
they, you know, they didn't want to scare any people off that they might have caught otherwise. And secondly, drugs are an integral part of our economy. And if you don't believe me, try watching the news without seeing a pharmaceutical ad. And, and if you can't afford a regular pharmaceutical, a regular narcotic is available cheap on your corner, because the war on drugs, like the war on anything, makes stuff cheaper and easier to get.
Yeah, but Hal, one last thing, and you can let me go after this, but these poppies are also an integral part of a war against the Russian people, because a lot of the heroin is getting shipped directly to Russia right now. And I think their heroin addiction population has almost tripled in the past decade.
Russia uses somewhere in the order of, like, I think 275 tons of refined heroin a year.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the order of, I think, I want to say 12 or 16% of the world's usage.
Yeah.
Just in Russia alone. Now, again, that's, you know, less a population clearing by the U.S. government or the allies, and the fact that, we have to honestly look at the fact that Russia is in many ways a thugocracy.
Uh-huh.
It has been for a long time. It's run by a mafia. It's a mafia state, which is why Obama's act to, like, eliminate nuclear weapons and severely start drawing those things down has been one of the most important positive steps in that area, because you don't want a nation of gangsters and drug addicts.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably, some of those bombs are safer in Pakistan.
Yeah, but the Russian president who met with Obama last week, if he would have asked that question in the Oval Office, like, Mr. President, will you do anything about the poppy fields? What do you think he said about that?
Well, I don't think he said anything, because I don't think the Russians did anything about the poppy fields while they were there either.
Mm.
I don't think this is
Good
an American
point.
Instigation on this. I think, quite frankly, most of what we're not doing about that is because we take that in the same way, shutting down the poppy fields is the equivalent of stopping the Iraqi of disbanding the Iraqi army the minute we walked in. You create a situation where people have no options, and when you have an entire society where they have no options, the options that they start choosing, the dire ones, get worse and worse and more violent.
Right.
And
yeah.
And if you look at how, when we put a hard line rule on drugs in this country, usage goes up, crime goes up, violence goes up. And so if you look at, if you're going to overlay that on any country, if you're going to say, okay, we'll take the American plan, a zero tolerance policy, burn the fields, then all you're going to get is the worst gangsters. Those are the only people who are going to be willing to make money off of it. And it will become, the Taliban will start ruling based on that. Right now, it's a soft crop that a lot of people grow and a lot of independent people grow.
Yeah.
If you really come down on it like a hammer, it gets more and more narrow. I got to go because I'm running up against
Good
the break.
Good talking to you, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I'm going to get to the rest of the calls right after this break, because we've got to take a break. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. Deirdre and Phil and George and Glenna, we'll get to you guys coming up right after this break. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks. 1-800-STEP-12. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's all about fun. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEP-12 is the number.
And you've been fantastic.
That's the song, isn't it, Tony? Yeah. Let's go. I want to get to some of these calls, because some people have been holding on for quite some time. Let's go to Glenna, and then we'll go to Phil after that. Glenna.
Hi.
You there? Hiya.
Oh, first time caller here.
Oh, right on. I wish I had a sound effect for you like Randy Rhodes does. She pops a cork or some
great
nonsense. I don't know. And I don't have Steph's box to play with. So.
Okay.
That has sound effects in it, of course, as Steph's box would.
Yes, indeed.
It makes lots of noises.
It's a magic box.
Yeah, it is. It's got special powers. Go ahead. So, beg your pardon. Okay.
Yes. Listening to all this morning, it finally occurred to me what the GOP and Rush Limbaugh and the teabaggers think the government is good for.
Mm-hmm.
bail out business when it screws up.
So yeah, now, absolutely.
So now the question becomes, how big does that government have to be to bail out business every time it screws up?
Well, they don't want government very big. They want a lot of taxes taken from a big swath of regular workers to draw that, and very small government to hand that out. Now, I've made the case, and I thank you for the call, because we have a ton of people, and I really want to get to them, and I appreciate it, and it's an excellent point. I've made the case for not just big government, because this seems to be the thing, I'm anti-big government. I mean, not only do we need big government, we need humongous government. Because basically, all you need, I don't need medium-sized government, and even small government in my life. I don't need a government that's big enough to fit through my front door. I need and check what I'm doing in my bedroom. I need a government that can handle hurricanes and great worldwide depressions and meteors heading towards the earth. You really do. I mean, things you can't do on your own. And by the way, you know how when they build a big stadium for a sports team, and they give them all these tax breaks, and they build it for zero construction costs, and the city protects them, and this corporation, a corporation of millionaires who play games for a living, get all these breaks, and we nod and roll right through. And then, when we want to spend money as a stimulus package on the highways and freeways and waterways and sewer systems and treatment plants of this country, we look like that's a huge reach. Why would you do that with taxpayer money? That's our bailout. That's our tax benefit. That's your new stadium is your clean life, your ability to do whatever you want to do. And the best way to do it is on safe, secure roads with traffic lights that run the way they're supposed to, with plumbing and clean water the way it's supposed to run. That's your equivalent of when a stadium gets built and they get everything for free. Your taxpayer money gets spent or not collected so these guys can do stuff. And in this case, your tax money is not being collected to turn into other stuff. For example, guns and bombs in this, which we spend way too much on, but is finally being put to work. Stimulus packages and jobs bills, those kind of things. That's your bailout. That's what the bailout is. So, let me go to Phil in Rochester. Phil, you there?
Hey, I'm here.
Great. Thanks for hanging out.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be really quick. I want everyone to get on real
quick.
Just a quick story that you were talking about the Tea Party earlier. And in the fall, I'm in Rochester, New York. I happened to have a bunch of business downtown, which had me skirting around the rally that they had. Rochester's a pretty darn good-sized city. There had to be at least 200 people there. And I noticed as I walked through the first time that there was one black person.
Right.
It just caught my eye. Second time through, I ended up crossing paths with her, and she was carrying a bag, and I kind of helped her because she was fumbling with it. Small talk, nothing important, and she asked if there was a good place to eat around here. I said, where are you from? Oh, Chicago. I just flew in this morning. I'm flying out this evening, but I'm starving. Told her about a restaurant around the corner. Exchanged pleasantries, went on. She ended up being the keynote speaker, the only black person there.
Right.
And her entire speech, because I heard it as I was crossing across the quad later on, she had to say "we" at least 10 times that I heard, as far as "we love living here in Rochester, and we need to take Rochester back, and we need to take this over." And she wasn't from here.
Right. So they're basically funneling in minorities to make themselves look less like a white organization.
Exactly. Because the picture in the paper the next day was this young, beautiful black speaker.
Local black Rochester woman speaks out against...
Oh, they didn't identify her.
Right.
But that was the front page picture, was this young, beautiful black, 30-ish-year-old woman who had never been here before and was just flown in for the occasion.
Go figure. Interestingly enough, and why the tea parties have dissipated, and we talked a little bit about with both Lee and Eric, was the idea that once these handlers, these astroturfing groups, came up against a situation like BP, where they had to go against a corporation, they just split ways. Even their own followers, they tend to lean more in the direction of somewhere between Alex Jones and Ron Paul. And it's a tough thing for them to, swallow. So they end up, cutting ties with their own corporate handlers. I got to move on, and I appreciate the
Absolutely.
Call.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Bye.
I've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to get to Deirdre before we take a break. Deirdre in Annapolis, Maryland.
How are you?
I'm great.
Yeah, you are wired today.
Oh, it's true. You know what it is? It's not sleeping. I'm always better.
I recognize that syndrome of the faster you go, the behinder you get.
Right.
In any case, I was thinking over the weekend that they always latch on to something that they're going to get President Obama on, and then when he actually solves it, you never hear about it again.
Uh-huh.
And the case in point was the underwear bomber from last December, which was going to bring our country down faster than 9/11.
Oh, of course.
And he actually pled guilty on Friday. I didn't hear that on Fox all
weekend.
But it was solved. That the lawyers who defended him, that they read him his rights, they actually solved it.
Yep, and that he actually confessed and gave actionable intelligence.
It's like everything else. As soon as it gets solved, it dissipates into the ethernet.
Because it doesn't. Again, it's about that fact spread. It doesn't serve their narrative, so it's never going to be heard. And an excellent point, Deirdre. I got to take a break.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Yeah. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph. We're in our last half hour of the show, and we have a bunch of calls on the line. I want to get to Glenn and Jim and Fred and Mike and George and Brad when we get back after this break. It's stunning. By the way, with Elena Kagan going through her confirmation process right now, we are seeing the last twitches in many ways, of a very conservative Supreme Court. They look like they are making a hard rush to get all these corporate rules passed before one of them has to go and the tide shifts permanently for a couple of years. Because between Citizens United, the state gun laws, the retraction of the Madoff law, we'll talk about it when we come back. 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm Hal Sparks. We'll be back right after this. The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in while the Mooks and Steph are away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Let's go to George in Syracuse, New York. George is on line 6. There he is. Hi, George.
Hi. I have a question. The thing is that nobody is addressing how the average Afghan feels about the situation in Afghanistan. We're all saying either, oh, stay around there forever or get the hell out of there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that I tend to feel that if we go right now, then we are going to leave a failed state in Afghanistan.
Right.
And that what is going to happen is the Taliban could come back. And they're going to have plenty more recruits there because what we're basically telling the people is down there is we don't care either way. We're mm-hmm. in it just simply to keep the terrorists out or whatever.
Right.
But if we tell them that we don't care either way, then they're just going to get alienated. And there'll be more terrorists.
Right. Well, I think you illustrate very well how complicated this decision is. And insofar as how the average Afghan feels, the problem with this whole situation is there's no such thing as an average Afghan.
I know.
There's such a mix, both socially and tribally, of this area. Now, a lot of these countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, they are bordered countries that we created, and the British and the European powers created where there were none. We created borders and lines and divine countries on maps that did not exist. These were simply tribal people that moved back and forth. And once we set that down and we started drilling for the minerals in each of these areas, they were more lines for us than they were for them.
I know, but the thing is that is overly complicating things. What I'm simply saying is
Look, we created the Afghan government, and then God knows that Yahoo from Crawford decided to go on his little adventure in Iraq, and so things got calcified in Afghanistan, and there was then the corruption was allowed to come in for six full years.
Well, I think it is by nature a very complicated area.
I know, but the thing is that there could be a few basic things that could be done. We, the Afghan government, is our creature, and we have to be able to have the guts to admit that.
Well, yeah,
can I finish?
Sure.
We have to exert pressure on them. You know, maybe questionable pressure on them. We have to be able to say to those warlords, look, either you get the business end of a Predator missile, or you can take those poppies and try to turn something productive out of them. Or you can simply say to Karzai, listen, we know what your brother's doing. We can either make things good for him, or we can make things bad for him.
Well, that is exactly what we have been doing for nearly 6 years. The problem is that government that we are using does not have the reach of the U.S. government or any other government in another normal country. It is sporadic and sparse and is conflicting and competing with the Taliban and small patches of what we consider to be Al Qaeda and different religious and tribal entities that exist and are totally, for all practical purposes, disconnected from the Karzai government and couldn't give a crap whether or not it was implemented by the United States or not. And also is so disconnected from it that they view an attack on themselves as an attack on their tribal people, not as, oh, I'm the bad guy in this situation because I'm trying to oust Karzai. I could give a damn who he is. So that's what I'm saying. It's not overly complicating the idea. It's that it's that complicated an issue. And I thank you for the call. I want to make sure I get to everybody else that's in here. Let's go to Brad in Chicago. Brad, you there?
Hi, I am here, yes.
How are you? So your question is about why the mainstream media isn't doing anything about Fox, as it were.
Exactly. I'm not a religious sort of say person, but I know people that follow Fox.
Yeah.
Some of them are. So why don't they call it what it is? They seem to be the serpent or the snake that spoke to Jesus in the garden.
Right.
They're telling lies and spreading rumors about good things.
Yeah, well, they seem to have no problem. You know, it's amazing to me that they, you know, this concept of the wolf in sheep's clothing seems to fit them very well amongst their own, you know, the kind of people who would follow them. I think there are areas where they do. I think CNN, unfortunately, has a bad record of false parody in an attempt to, they took the Fox's success with the moniker Fair and Balanced to heart and actually thinks that they've got to compete on a fair and balanced level with somebody who's not even playing on that level. So effectively CNN brings a plastic knife to a gunfight. And and MSNBC, though, I think does a great job of it. I think both Rachel and Keith dissect things very well in that regard. I think unfortunately, with the heavy level of embed and the heavy level of, you know, this fight for access, which we kind of talked about with Eric Bollard earlier, when you have that situation where you need access and you're willing to kind of toe the line on occasion to get that access, the issue then becomes you're part of the problem as well. You're now telling some stories truthfully and some stories not at all. And then it's a house of cards. If you start throwing stones at Fox, you feel like they could throw stones at you, and you can't stand up to it.
Well, it's because news medias aren't news anymore. There's a law that was passed that they can be entertainment now,
right,
too, and still they call themselves news.
Well, it's because they also don't broadcast. A lot of them, you know, if you look at the networks, they still run a nightly news program about the same time as they always have. But the 24-hour news channels are all cable, so they have they don't buy bandwidth. They don't actually buy or rent anything from the American people, and in exchange for that have to provide a service. They are simply and cleanly they might as well be TLC or A&E or, you know, ID channel or whatever. They don't have to provide a service of any sort because they don't take up our airwaves.
I see.
Yeah.
But if with the right-wing talking points, why don't they take the ammo that they always use and use a right-wing talking point of your or a left-wing talking point of their own? And
I think you're absolutely right. I think you have to, you know, it's an information war. There's no question. And there's a lot of information viruses out there. The whole push towards the deficit reduction is part of the problem. You know, they've been pushing this ever since. And if you look at history, one of the worst things that you can do, and this is, you know, Krugman was talking about this today. You look at the cover of Huffington Post and, you know, how we're looking at another, a possible double dip recession. It's 100% because of people have this debt fear. And the reason they don't want this, you know, the debt fear is because the corporations don't want us actually bailed out as individuals. They want the bailout to stop with them. And if it goes too far in their direction, we'll get, you know, the middle class will get seated again and in a position of strength. But they can't have that.
They're going to buy their products.
Well, you know, the world is divided up into two sort of groups as far as those products go. There's the, you know, the upper middle class and ruling class that have a decent amount of money and are, you know, management class. And then there's all the other people who buy soda by the gallon. And,
right.
And they're fine with that distinction. They're fine with selling, laptops and luxury cars to, on credit. To upper middle class people who can't truly afford it will prorate it out over time and stay indebted so they can never really shake it, and selling junk food and crap and clothing with formaldehyde in it and all the kinds of nonsense like that to poor people all over the country and making that group as big as possible. So there's no loss in this for them. Look at the potato chip market and tell me that you go broke making crap for a lot of people at a low price. That's the business they really want to be in. They don't want to develop. Most companies, one of the reasons companies hate Apple is because Apple sets a standard that they have to maintain, that other companies have to live up to, and they hate it. They would much rather cramp out like the Zune and dump it onto the market with a third of the, you know, features and sell it at a tenth of the price, and never have to update it, because that's how they view the public.
Until the American public actually wakes up, and if they're still following right wing nuts, it's going to stay this way until they actually stand up in alliance together.
I totally agree. I mean, I think ultimately it's an individual choice to have a standard, an ethical standard, and a quality standard in your life. It always starts with you. It always starts with the individual who's going, you know what, this life, this kind of stuff, this idea of being just kind of a blatant consumer of whatever garbage comes along, that's not a life. And I refuse to live at that standard. And I'm going to define for myself what my life should mean. And I'm going to hold myself to that standard, regardless of what the kind of, how much fast food they're offering me for 99 cents. That's really the issue. I have to go because I have to take a bunch of calls.
Thank you.
Absolutely, appreciate it. Let's go to Jim in Oklahoma City. Jim, you there?
Hi. I was going segueing back to the Afghan topic. I heard the last part of a gentleman talking about the poppy fields.
Right.
I remember a few years ago, maybe it was last year, there was an idea or a thought that if it was possible that you could take the poppy and turn it into whether medicinal morphine or something, or make it an above board industry. Because ultimately,
let's be real clear. Heroin was created by the Bayer Aspirin Company. Bayer created heroin. They even named it heroin for its heroic use against in the fight against pain.
Okay.
That's where the name came from, and it was an opiate used to control pain. It became a narcotic because of its ease of process. One of the ways the pharmaceutical companies have made sure that they can keep the money in their hands is they make sure that they're using opiates. A lot of these Zoloft and all these kind of drugs, they're not, don't be confused, these are narcotics, but they are so complex to make that you can't make your own Zoloft. And so they that's the problem they have with heroin, is you can make it yourself. Go ahead.
Well, ultimately, what I think is, okay, you can have an Afghan farmer and he wants to put, or whatever, a tribal leader wants to take care of his family.
Right.
They want to put food on the table and a roof over there. That's basically what it boils down to, is if they can get to that point where they don't have to worry about that, and they have an income, and they don't have to worry about getting paid, whether it be by Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or whatever, that somehow, I mean, and I don't think exchanging wheat for heroin actually is going to pay off economically for them.
No, it certainly, I mean, you're asking somebody to take a $100 a bushel crop and change it in for an $8 a bushel crop, and nobody's going to take that, especially when they're already impoverished and they need ammo. Like, you're telling people who live in the middle of nowhere, who have a tribal nomadic society where people roll through every so often and kidnap large groups of them and run off with their children, and you're going to tell me that I have to, the money that I'm going to cut back on is going to keep me from buying an AK-47
to protect
my family. It's absurd. The notion is, ultimately, you have two choices. The hard choice is make drugs legal, let them exist as a real thing, and then fight it on a social level because you think it's not necessary for society. And which is what they do in the Netherlands, and they've done it to great effect. Or you establish a war on drugs like we have, and you make drugs cheaper and more available and more violent.
Yes, and I'm afraid that's the path that we're going to go down in Afghanistan.
Well, part of it is, you know, we as an American people. Now, I think, interestingly enough, it takes a while for it to trickle up, especially to the military zones of things, because they tend to be 100 years behind everybody else. Mm-hmm. Look at Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The rest of the country has moved on, and it's the military that's the holdup. That's what's slowing this down, is that they were freaking out at the idea. They're about 15 years behind as minimum all the time, because they feel like they're dealing with an old problem. But if you look at the war on drugs is like every other war we've ever declared on anything. Anything we've ever declared war on is actually doing better now for having the war declared on it, even Japan. You literally look at Japan as a society now. They're integral to the world's economy. They're integral to the world's technology. They're an amazing society. And we did more damage to them. We did the most warlike thing we knew how to do. We dropped 2 nuclear bombs on them. Everything that in that situation where we just decide we're going to declare war on poverty. Poverty has gone up since then. There are more people who need, assistance with food now than there ever were. And it tripled since the war on poverty started. War on crime, same thing. It doesn't work that way. You can't use war as a tactic for changing social needs.
So ultimately, what can we do for the Afghan farmer who needs to put food on his table because that's what's going to stop this thing or make them self-sufficient, is when they can take care of themselves and when they can feed themselves, clothe themselves. What is it?
Well, I'll tell you, that's exactly why we're not coming down hard on the opium trade in Afghanistan. And it's 100% why. That's a tough decision to make. But if you were in a position, I guarantee if you, sir, Jim in Oklahoma City, if you were president of the United States and you were faced with 9 or 10 crap options in a country like Afghanistan, and one of those options was leaving it completely alone, allowing the 50 al-Qaeda members who are actually maybe 10 of them are upper level to get a Pakistan nuclear missile and dirty bomb and drag it into Spain, which they're never going to get it to the United States, but they could get it to Madrid. If that's one of your options, and your other option is placate these people by making sure that they can make a living selling drugs, you're going to choose that one.
Yeah.
And I think this president has. I think the Bush administration was more than happy to do it because, quite frankly, they want the pipeline that's going through there.
Yeah.
But I think we have made that decision all along in a lot of areas where we've gone, okay, it's not even the lesser of two evils. It's the lesser of 19 evils.
Yeah.
I've got to take a break, and I really thank you for bringing up that particular conversation about it, Jim. Yeah, cheers. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph. We're into the last 10 minutes of the show, Tony. We're going to try to get through some of these calls. People have been hanging on. It's a great conversation. 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're on vacation. We'll be right back after this.
A perpetual motion machine, endlessly satisfying every human need.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Steph and Mooks while they're away on vacation. Yeah, that's King's X. That's right. The world around me. Let's go. I've only got a few minutes, and I want to get to everybody. Let's go to Glenn in Ontario, Canada. Glenn, are you there?
Hello. Hi. Yes, I am. Thank you.
I think the get away from the old media is the problem. The old media is CNN, the Fox, and
sure.
all the rest of them. It's all the old. It's dying. That's the dinosaur. And the sooner they're dead, the better. Go online, people. That's where the information is. TV News Live.
Well, the interesting thing is you can also go, the nice thing is you can go to Guardian UK.
Blog,
you can go
9/11 Blogger, yeah. Collapse Net. All these sites are online and the information is out there. What we're talking about, what the mainstream media talk about, is never what really happened. The underwear bomber, for instance, was a patsy. That was a setup to tell Obama, listen, the CIA, we're in charge here, sir. So don't step out of line. All these things have another motive than the They're more complicated.
Right. Well, I think George Carlin said it right. Is always no matter what, always question the official story.
Exactly.
No matter
right.
what.
And anybody out there, the sooner 9/11 truth is revealed, there'll be peace in the world, and the greatest civics lesson in history will come from 9/11 truth.
Well, I think we owe it to ourselves, no matter what people end up believing. And I thank you for the call, by the way. I want to get to a bunch of people because we got a lot of people holding. That you always owe it to yourself. To look at least one level below anything that causes you stress, look one more level below it. Just because a lot of times you'll find it that it disintegrates. Mike in Los Angeles.
Hey, Hal, I just want to see you doing a superb job even without Stephanie's box.
Oh, thank you. Yes, and it's sorely missed, I have to say.
I also wanted to observe that an American victory in Afghanistan is inevitable because we're funding both sides in the Civil War through the payoffs our contractors, of whom there are more than military personnel in country, are paying to the Taliban indirectly for protection.
Oh, well, no question. I mean, we've been bribing our way up and down that country for a long time, and quite frankly, if you look at those as mineral rights payments, it makes sense. It's the same thing we do in other countries, except we do it without the military being present.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same activity.
Yeah, we're
going to rent this, but we're going to rent it at the barrel of a gun.
Yeah. I also wanted to say, though, that it's very easy to get a nuke into the U.S. If you're Al-Qaeda and you just buy a Chinese corporation.
Right. Well, yeah, because you can do more damage that way, you know. And I appreciate the call. I've got a couple minutes left, and you make some excellent points. Let's see. Actually, I'm actually out of time. I got 1 minute left. I'm Hal Sparks. I've been filling in for Steph today. I'm here all week. I'll be streaming at halsparks.com/ustream. You can join us in the chat there. Of course, I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter. Tomorrow, my special, Charmageddon, comes out on DVD on Amazon.com and on iTunes. You can download it. Very exciting. It's also on demand on Showtime all this month. Very exciting. We will see you tomorrow. And we will be dealing with a bunch of things. But we also, this week, got some guests. Your regulars, John Fugelsang, will be with us later on in the week. David Bender. Stay tuned. Come and see me tomorrow. And we will continue this conversation. I think we might actually find our way around some answers to them as well. I'm Hal Sparks. This is the Stephanie Miller Show.